Hello all, this is Patrick. Just before the episode begins, I want to quickly acknowledge that it is World Hemophilia Day, April 17th, and we expect that there are going to be all kinds of pictures, event recaps, news stories, and press releases that come out not just today, but throughout this entire week. So Bloodstream Media's Facebook and Twitter channels will be largely dedicated this week to helping share this content as it comes out. So after you listen to this, our special World Hemophilia Day episode, check out Bloodstream Media on Facebook and Twitter to see how the world is celebrating World Hemophilia Day. Also, I want to let you know that the Bloodstream podcast is now sponsored exclusively by Shire. Shire believes in the educational and community empowerment merits of what we're doing over here at the Bloodstream podcast, and they have made a commitment to helping us further our mission. So we want to give a big thank you to Shire for that. Thank you. Okay, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to Bloodstream Episode 11, April 17th, 2017. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie DeLilla.
And on this World Hemophilia Day episode, we are doing all things World Hemophilia Day. We're going to be pointing out a couple different World Hemophilia Day campaigns and goings-on today, a big international day for our community. We have a special World Hemophilia Day segment featuring our conversations in Senegal when we went with the World Federation of Hemophilia in 2015. We're going to present you with a nice mashup segment of various interviews and sound bites from that trip. And in just a little bit, Natalie is going to do an interview with me on my recent trip to Nepal and engagement with the Nepal Hemophilia Society as part of Bombardier Blood, the documentary chronicling Chris Bombardier's historic summit attempt of Mount Everest. All of that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. How are you doing today, Natalie?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's the first day that I've seen you since you've been back, so.
It's kind of fun. We've obviously talked a bit about the Nepal trip, but we've kind of held back to a certain degree so that you could actually ask me questions about it that you yourself don't know the answer to. We don't have to pretend.
These will be genuine questions and genuine responses since we just connected 12 hours ago.
So just to provide a little bit of background and then get to a little bit of business with regards to, we have a lot going on at Bloodstream Media and at Believe Limited. It's World Hemophilia Day. We just finished HFA's symposium. So a lot of little things to kind of get to before we dive into our two featured segments for this episode, which is that interview that Natalie's going to host and conduct, and our WFH Humanitarian Aid Program Treatment for All series segment that features all these interviews and sound bites from our trip with WFH to Senegal to learn about hemophilia in the developing world back in 2015. So those are our two centerpiece segments for this episode. But before we get into all of that, it is World Hemophilia Day, which is a global day of advocacy and awareness. And in particular this year, there's an emphasis from the WFH on the awareness of women with bleeding disorders around the world. As those of us who are particularly active in the community know, women with bleeding disorders and ensuring that women with bleeding disorders are getting the appropriate care that they need is kind of an ongoing challenge, both here in America and abroad. And it's neat to see that the WFH has answered the call from numerous women activist groups to say, hey, can you do a little bit more to profile what our needs are? And I'm pleased to say that Bloodstream Media, just last week, on April 10th, released our first episode of a brand new three-part series on all things von Willebrand disease. And while von Willebrand disease is not female-specific, it occurs actually about equally in both men and women for a various number of reasons, some of which are more obvious than others. Von Willebrand disease is often more associated with women, and its impact on women's life can be more substantial than on men's life. On a whole, I'm speaking very generally. I know that's not true for every guy with VWD. But anyway, I'm just glad that we are kind of participating in awareness building of the most common bleeding disorder and the one that affects women more than any other. And that series is the first of our new Bloodline series of podcasts. So Bloodline is sort of a This American Lifestyle deeper dive into topics of interest in this community. And von Willebrand disease is the first one that we are profiling. And I think it's come out really, really well.
It's awesome. Yeah.
So in total, throughout February and March, I interviewed 10 people, two clinicians, one male, one female, seven patients/patient parents, and one parent. So 10 people in total. Some men, some women, some from the US, some from abroad, some from the developed world, some from the developing world, to talk essentially about the comprehensive impact that VWD has on someone's life as growing up as a kid. And we talked to people, I think our youngest individual was 18 and our oldest in her mid-50s. So it's a great range of people from all over the place, all different kinds of stories, but a lot of common threads. I don't want to give too much away, but we did create a little teaser, a little sizzle, if you will, to get a sense of what that series is like. So here, take a listen to this teaser from the new VWD Bloodline series.
I was diagnosed when I was 12.
I was diagnosed at birth.
I was 6 when I was diagnosed.
I was 16 and 8 months when I was diagnosed.
My diagnosis is type 1 von Willebrand's and a severe non-specific platelet aggregation defect.
I have von Willebrand's disease, type 1.
I have type 2B von Willebrand's.
I was diagnosed with von Willebrand disease type 2M.
Diagnosis is von Willebrand's type 3 severe.
Essentially, my platelets don't send the signals they need to get that chain reaction kicked off for forming a platelet plug, so I can't form the beginning stages of a clot properly.
I've kind of fluctuated between mild and moderate through different stages of my life. Right now, I'm currently mild.
It's type 3. It's obviously the most severe of the von Willebrand's and most rare.
Excessive, frequent, and prolonged periods. Uncontrollable and unpredictable nosebleeds, pain and bruising, complications with births, social isolation, generations undiagnosed. Von Willebrand disease, or VWD, is a genetic disorder caused by missing or defective clotting proteins and named after Erik von Willebrand, the Finnish researcher who discovered the disorder. It can be painful, confusing, frustrating, and isolating. The symptoms and effects of those symptoms are internal and external, and it affects up to 1 in 100 people, making it the single most common bleeding disorder in humans. So why have so few people heard of von Willebrand disease, or VWD? And on a related and more important note, why are so few people diagnosed with it? Research has shown that 90%, or 9 in 10 people with VWD, have not been diagnosed. And for the 1 in 10 who are diagnosed, the average time to diagnosis is 16 years. You heard that correctly. It is believed that the average time from symptoms of von Willebrand disease to diagnosis of von Willebrand disease is 16 years. So we have to ask, is this a crisis? To answer that question, we're going to take you to meet VWD carriers and clinicians around the country and the world. We're going to hear their stories, their struggles, their victories, and we're going to attempt to answer the biggest questions about von Willebrand disease. But before we get to the biggest question of them all, are we in the midst of a healthcare crisis when it comes to the undiagnosed von Willebrand population? Let's start with something smaller, more specific, and tangible. A nosebleed that won't stop, a bruise that won't go away, a joint ache that throbs for days, a heavy, painful period.
I had had symptoms my entire life, anywhere from nosebleeds to bruising, weird joint pain that, of course, everyone was like, oh, you're too young to have that. I'm Kira Bechet. I'm 18 years old. I live in Colorado. The big kicker for me was when I hit puberty and my periods were horrendous, and it was something we had in the family, and it was just chalked up to, oh, it's just genetics.
That suite of symptoms is not uncommon. And several of our guests from around the world share a similar story, including...
It was something we had in the family, and it was just chalked up to, oh, it's just genetics.
In other words, the message is often, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about this. This is Andrea.
My daughter, at 3 weeks old, she had a nosebleed, so we brought her to the emergency room, and then we were told that there's nothing to worry about. She was just anemic. And I told the doctor about the history of my family, that there's hemophilia A in my father's family and my mom died of bleeding. And they said, oh, she cannot be a bleeder because she's a girl. She grew up having all those bruises and nosebleeds, and she would vomit blood occasionally. And I was just so frustrated when she was around 7 or 8 years old because she would nosebleed every day. And I really don't think that was normal.
So again, you can listen to the Bloodline VWD series by going to bloodstreammedia.com and following the appropriate links to that series.
And also today on World Hemophilia Day, something exciting is also occurring. Can you tell everyone what that is?
That was extraordinarily vague. But I know what you're talking about, so yes, right. I can. Yes, I can.
You know, you always like to create suspense on here and, you know, just give little teasers, so I was trying to follow suit, but nice. I'm just not as good as you.
I think it went... I'm sorry, right, say so that again?
I don't... What part? Suspense... Anyways, today is the launch of Stop the Bleeding Season 7.
It's Stop the Bleeding Season 7, our biggest season yet, 10-episode season, with each episode revolving around one central topic, which is a shift from what we've done in the past. And the topic for our World Hemophilia Day launch is, drumroll please,
World Hemophilia Day!
Hey! So, the launch episode for Season 7 is all about World Hemophilia Day and how Spencer, my character, tries to rally the ragtag group of healthcare workers that are at Stop the Bleeding to caring about hemophilia around the globe. Really proud of how the episode came out. You know, when you talk about hemophilia around the world, 75% of people don't have access to care. Half of people with severe hemophilia die before age 10. These are heavy things to kind of come to grips with, and it's hard.
And to make funny.
And, you know, we spend a lot of time figuring out how can we do this in a way that's both sensitive and respectful, but entertaining, because if it's not entertaining, we're not fulfilling the promise of what that program is intended to be. And I have to say, I think we did really, really well.
That's a hard balance.
It is. And our second episode is on insurance and advocacy, which is another thing, like, how do you make this interesting and funny? But, you know, look, I not to be too, like, you know, patting ourselves on the back, we know what we're doing, and we've gotten really good at it, and we have good people working on it, so they've come out really, really well. You can check them out at stbhemo.com. So yeah, episode 1 on World Hemophilia Day. When you're done listening to the Bloodstream podcast, go over to stbhemo.com or at facebook.com/stbhemo. So yeah, after you're done listening to this podcast, check it out. There's a couple other things to mention before we get into our two featured segments. The Hemophilia Federation of America's annual symposium just took place just last weekend in Rhode Island. It went very well. Unfortunately, you may have seen on social media, we had a booth at HFA, or at least that was our intention. But unfortunately, like a lot of people, a bunch of people on our team got stuck in Atlanta, bags got lost, everything's been found, but we never did actually have our booth. We got all kinds of swag ready, but unfortunately right now it's just going to be hanging out in the garage. So if you were looking for Bloodstream at HFA and you didn't see us, you're not crazy. We weren't there after all. But on the flip side, HFA I think went extraordinarily well, and I got just a couple things. I was texting with the CEO, Kimberly Hogstead, last night just to let her know, is there anything that you want to kind of highlight from the meeting for the Bloodstream audience? There were over 1,100 people in attendance, which is about the same that they had last year, but last year's was in Vegas, which, no offense, Rhode Island, slightly different draw of a city, so I think if you put those two things side by side, that's a really good sign that they still had 1,100 people in Rhode Island.
I mean, I'd prefer Providence over Vegas.
Well, I know, but now that's a whole debate. But it was a great family meeting. There was an event feel that was quite warm and intimate, Kimberly stated, and I do agree that feeling, I think that's generally true at HFA, and that's something I tell people when you kind of compare HFA's meeting and NHF's. HFA does have a more intimate feel, and not that there's anything wrong with a bigger, grandiose feel, but that's one of the unique qualifiers or the unique qualities of HFA's symposium. They had a really cool final night experience that Rich Pizzillo helped set up, as NEHA, the New England Hemophilia Association, was the host chapter. It was absolutely beautiful. If you haven't seen pictures, if you check out HFA's Facebook page, you'll see pictures from the final night event. They had buildings all around downtown Rhode Island lit up in red. They had this amazing gondola ride going on in the lake there. Not the lake. What is it? What body of water was it? A river? It was a river. There was a river and a
in
bay.
In the water.
In the water area. Yeah. You know, Rich gave me the most brilliant breakdown of, like, there's fresh water
and
comes in from
it all.
Here. So, well, the guy, you know, first of all, Rich.
That's an estuary.
I don't know what that is, sweetheart.
Salt, where salt water meets fresh water.
Okay, there you go, everybody. This is an estuary. So this is an educational podcast. But it was beautiful. It was a really, really beautiful evening. And I did see that there was some, I think the Providence Journal did some coverage on it and on hemophilia as a result of the just stunning visual that this scene created. So kudos to HFA and to Rich for a great meeting and a great final night event to cap it all off. And excitingly enough, at least for the two of us, next year's meeting will be held in Cleveland, Ohio.
Hey, I wanted to say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, Natalie, where's next year's meeting being held?
You know, in my own hometown, Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, you don't say. That's really cool, Natalie. Yeah, next year's meeting is going to be in Natalie's hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. So we're pretty excited about that. I'm sure your family will be excited about that as well.
I mean, I was going to say I didn't come this year to Rhode Island, but if you want to meet me next year, I will definitely be there in Cleveland.
That's a tease. That's a one-year tease that you're laying right now, huh?
Most likely, probably will be there.
Okay.
I don't like to lie, so most likely, probably.
Most likely, probably. Thank you for being so something.
Yeah, so next year's in Cleveland.
Okay, so that takes care of our business pre-featured segments. Now we'll get into our two World Hemophilia Day specific segments, the first of which is the interview of me by Natalie, who is currently staring at me with like very interviewee eyes, looking at her notes. It's kind of an intimidating picture that you're striking right now.
Well, I like how you're kind of laughing at me before I even get started. This is fun. This is fun to be the interviewer, since you normally are.
And I have no idea I don't know what these are going to be. So
I was giving him joke questions as he was setting up the equipment.
Joke questions.
You know, like, you know, how was the plane food on the ride over? Mm-hmm. But I have better questions.
Decent,
than
though,
that.
Honestly. The answer to that is decent. Uh huh. Yeah, so go ahead. Let's talk about Nepal.
Let's talk about Nepal. So for those of our audience who are tuning in maybe for the first time, mm-hmm. or have missed episodes in the past that you have teased Bombardier Blood.
Right.
Can you give a brief background on how of the inception of this project and...
Yeah, I appreciate your usage of the word brief. We'll see how you know.
I'll cut you off. I'm the interviewer.
Okay, there we go. Gauntlet Throne. Well, first of all, you just said it, and I should mention that we now have a title for the documentary, and that is Bombardier Blood. As you know, Natalie, that's been in my pocket for a little while, but we only on Friday, actually at HFA, I presented on the project and played a video from Nepal, which you can find at bombardierblood.com. But yeah, that was the first time we actually announced like what the title is. The website went live, and it's like a fully real thing now. To go back to your question, coincidentally enough, it was at HFA's meeting in 2016 that Chris Bombardier, the 31-year-old mountaineer with severe hemophilia B, said, and I only kind of knew him, but he just sent me a Facebook message saying, I want to talk to you about something. And that something was, he said, I'm climbing the seven summits, the highest mountain on each of the seven continents. And next year, I want to do Everest. It's the tallest of them all, 29,000 feet high. It's the one that everybody knows. And I'd like to capture it because I would like to show what is both possible and what is not possible when you have hemophilia, depending upon your access to care. And what he meant by that is that he didn't just want us to film him and training and climbing the mountain. He also wanted us to film with the Nepal hemophilia community. Mount Everest is located in Nepal, one of the world's poorest countries. And they obviously were devastated 18 months ago by a horrible earthquake, killed thousands of people, decimated homes all throughout the country. And Chris wanted to both show what people with hemophilia in Nepal, what their lives looked like. They don't have much medicine there. It's a much different quality of life. And what his life looked like as somebody who could climb mountains because he's on prophylaxis and he has good access to care. And I thought that was just a tremendous, like, as a filmmaker, as an activist, as a hemophiliac, as a content creator.
Yes, you said yes.
Yes, yes, yes. So that got the ball rolling. He's a board member of Save One Life. Save One Life, along with the World Federation of Hemophilia. Those are the two international nonprofits that do work in the developing world for people with bleeding disorders. He sits on that board. It's an organization founded by Lori Kelly. He wanted Save One Life and Lori to be a meaningful part of this project, particularly the Nepal hemophilia engagement component. So yeah, just last week, fast forward a little bit, I won't go through the whole thing, you know, with we talked to Octapharma specifically because actually, and they deserve credit for this, they are the largest corporate sponsor of Save One Life, and Wolfgang McGehr, their CEO, sponsors more children with hemophilia in the developing world than any other person on the planet. So we figured there's a great relationship right there. They're already
natural partnership.
They're bought into the mission. So if we can articulate the vision of this documentary and what this documentary could do to help expand awareness beyond just our community, but into the general public, maybe just maybe they'll say, you know what? Yeah, we want to get behind this. And they said yes.
Okay, so that was a very good explanation of how it all came to be. And so how was it? So you got this project funded and mm-hmm. you went a couple weeks ago to mm-hmm. Nepal. What surprised you?
About Nepal?
Yeah, and about the experience. Like, what was something that you went into the experience thinking would be one way and it was mm-hmm. different, or?
I keep saying this, so this must be one of the things that really surprised me. The Nepalese people are tremendous. And the community, yes, but just everyone in Nepal that we met in the week that we were there filming. And I like to say, like, we were aggressively in Nepal. You know, we're out early in the morning and we're out all day engaging with people and filming and observing from afar every day for a week. And I did not observe in an overcrowded city in one of the most polluted cities in the world and one of the poorest countries in the world. I did not observe a moment of anger. Not somebody laying on a car horn, somebody just screaming across a street, somebody yelling in a restaurant, nothing, not one moment of anger. I wasn't back in New York 5 minutes and it was like, oh, got the quota filled for the anger. But in Nepal, none.
So despite having very little, they seem to be, on the whole, very content, happy, and kind humans?
Yes, period, full stop. And I have never experienced a culture where I felt that before. So that has stuck with me and is something that I'm thinking a lot about now, being back here in the States.
And so considering the culture, how does that translate to how they view chronic disease, hemophilia in the family? And part of why I ask is because you were in Senegal last year
mm-hmm.
and the African culture.
In 2015, but yeah.
2015, you know, whatever. Basically last year.
Yeah.
But your work in Senegal and how in Africa, culturally,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to burden others with your problems.
Right. Yep.
This culture that you described in Nepal, how does that relate to disease in the family and in the community at large?
I mean, it's a good question. So it seems there's a very strong family unit in Nepal. There's one guy, Krishna, who we interviewed for the documentary, and he lives with his mom and his dad, his grandparents, and I think an aunt and uncle as well. And the family is a unit. And he even said at one point, without my family, I wouldn't have life. My family is my backbone. There's a great amount of working for the whole, both within the family and then just within the greater community. So the family, you can kind of understand that picture. But the way I also witnessed that beyond just the hemophilia community, you know, they haven't had cars in Nepal for a very long time, not in a kind of a ubiquitous way. And in Kathmandu, the traffic is crazy. It's totally crazy. And you first see it and like you're trying to cross streets and there's like never any stopping. So you're like, how does this work? And
it's a giant game of Frogger.
It is a giant game of Frogger that you have to play with confidence and intelligence and follow the lead of the locals. Follow the lead of the locals. But one of the things I notice is it oftentimes feels like every road is a one way where you're going the wrong way. But everyone's helping each other all the time, tapping on the car to let the car know, like, you've got a little more room, keep coming, harder taps to stop, shop owners just stepping out to help you back out of a driveway. Like, the culture is just one that it seems interested in helping one another. It's very service-oriented. And the way that that plays out in the hemophilia community, here's another good example. We had a young man, when we went to the hemophilia care unit, their equivalent of an HTC, and there was an 18-year-old guy who was just there that day. And we were like, hey, we're filming a documentary today at the hospital. You want to be a part of it? And, you know, kudos to him. He was there with a bleed. He lives 3 hours away. So he had to get on a public bus and travel 3 hours with his arm bleed to come to the hospital to get what was a 1,000 IU dose for a guy who probably, that's maybe a 50% correction based on his body weight. So in other words, not even a full infusion. And then he was getting on that bus and going 3 hours home again. And his friend came with him.
And to treat a bleed, not prophy.
No such thing as prophy in these circumstances. It's... Yeah, no such thing. He's treating a bleed with donated factor and treating it with one mild infusion. And his friend came with him just to, like, be a buddy.
In Nepal, a hemophilia diagnosis is a family diagnosis. It's a community diagnosis.
Yeah, and I'd say that's true anywhere, that, you know, hemophilia is a family disorder, it's a family disease. But in Nepal, the level to which hemophilia is going to burden a family life, and I say that word with respect, it's much higher. But rather than ostracize or criticize, or, you know, you have to keep in mind, you're also in a culture where there are arranged marriages and where the productivity of the male is important. And if you have hemophilia, you're not going to be a manual laborer. There are only so many jobs that are available in Nepal that are not manual labor. So societally, you're in a tough spot. It would be, I hate to say this, but I think you'll understand, it would be understandable if people with hemophilia were viewed as less than in some way by their family or burdensome in a negative way because of this reality. That does not appear to be the case whatsoever. Instead, you just do what you have to do to help one another out. If your son has a bleed and you live 2 hours from the hospital and you got to walk down this path to get to the road to the public bus, you know, we heard stories of mothers and fathers just carrying their kids on their back to go walk down to the bus, and you just figure it out, and you do so with grace and dignity. And it was extraordinarily impressive and inspiring to see. Hey again, it's me, Patrick, interrupting this interview of, well, me, Patrick. We'll get right back to that in a second, but I want to give a big thank you to the Bloodstream Podcast's sponsor, Shire. And as it is World Hemophilia Day, I have a couple bits of worldly info I recently learned about Shire from poking around on their website. Shire has the largest total portfolio of any biotech company serving patients with rare diseases. They also have over 22,000 employees across more than 100 countries. And, fun fact, Shire supports more than 60,000 patients in the U.S. through their patient assistance programs. So, on behalf of not only the Bloodstream podcast, but also patients across the U.S., thank you, Shire. All right, back to the interview.
You, one of your days, took a van ride and then ended up having to walk to the family's house that you were meeting with.
Yeah, well, we took a van ride until the van got stuck in the mud.
Right, right. Well, I was going to let you share that part.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, there you go.
You're just used to being the interviewer. Let me do my job, please.
Oh, my God, I'm sorry.
So you've expressed to me that that was your best day. Can you share with our audience a little bit what was so magical about that day?
Yeah, we were driving there, and as we were driving there, as the road started to get thinner and thinner, and we started to be like, where does this guy live? I mean, we knew we were going outside the city. We knew he was far away from the hospital and access to medicine. But the further out we got, I mean, it was beautiful, but you know, you also start like thinking, this guy's got hemophilia, and where does he live? And sure enough, at one point, the road was so muddy and just the van got stuck. So we were going to have to walk at a certain point anyway to get to his house because he just lives like up a mountain a little bit. But we had to get out prematurely when the van got stuck in the mud. So we had about an hour's hike ahead of us with all of our gear through this just, you could probably use better descriptors than I can, but it was just like this magical, it felt like a magical like jungle prairie. I don't even know what to call it. Just go to Bombardier Blood, watch the video. It's a stunning sight. This guy, Babesh, 18 years old, lives up there with his mom and his family. And we were asking, you know, what do you do when you get a bleed? Because like as beautiful as the walk was, it was really tough, both up and down. And like I said, it took us an hour to get up. And that was once we got off the main road, which was at least an hour from the hospital. And sure enough, he had recently been in the hospital. I think it was 3 weeks prior he said he had been. And when he needed to get down to the road, his mom carries him. And he's an 18-year-old. He's not a 4-year-old. And that's just what you have to do. It was an absolutely stunning place. And that same day, we went on to visit two other families at their homes in different kinds of settings. All three, you know, very poor. It's a very poor country. All three had homes that were damaged, if not ruined, by the earthquake. One family, the Umkushna, him and his family of, I think it's like six people, living in a shed that we here in the States would maybe like use for the lawnmower and like a few bicycles. That's where all six of them live because their home was destroyed in the earthquake and they don't have money to build a new home. So they live in that shed, and when he has bleeds, and he showed us his knee, it's quite damaged. He's had many bleeds. He just has to be in that shed, in that tin shed, and that's in the summer and the hottest days of the year. Just a stunning sight, a very sobering sight to see. But yeah, that was our day of home visits, and that was just one of the most magical days. It was one of the most magical days that I've ever experienced.
So after these visits with these families and being in Nepal, is there anything outside of medicine that you have discovered is a need in the developing world?
Money. I mean, they have nothing. You know, the average salary is like $1.20, $1.30 a month. I'm being casual, $130 a month. That's the average salary. So they just don't have much at all. Refrigeration. I mean, we talk about rice, rest, ice, compression, elevation. Like, they don't have ice.
Ice is a luxury.
You're not getting ice. Like, where's the ice coming from? Everything's a luxury. It's very minimalist living. And what's really interesting too, something I hadn't really thought about before, and it's similar in the States in a way. If you live in Kathmandu, again, it's one of the most polluted cities in the world, but it's where the hospital is. And we talked to some older guys with hemophilia, because miraculously they have some older guys with severe hemophilia, older guys being guys in their 40s and early 50s, you know, which unfortunately is rare in the developing world with severe hemophilia. And they live in the city, you know, and it's polluted and it's crowded and it's in many ways unpleasant, but it's nearer to the hospital. So when they get bleeds, they want to be closer to where the factor is. Whereas if you go out to where Babesh lives, it is absolutely stunning, but you are very far away from care. So it's a trade-off. And that was something I wasn't quite aware of. But yeah, I mean, honestly, in terms of like what the needs are beyond medicine, everything is a need.
And do you have any fears surrounding the mission or the project? And if so, how have they changed since the commencement and since leaving Nepal?
No, I don't. I don't have any fears. You know, there's, and Chris has spoken very openly with me about, you know, people, bad things happen on Everest every year. You know, you hear stories of things that happen. And of course, there's a healthy concern for a guy climbing Everest, not because he has hemophilia, just that's a hard thing to do. But Chris is extraordinarily smart. And he's prepared. And oftentimes, if you actually, his mom said this in one of the interviews for the documentary, if you actually look at some of the bad things that happen, when you hear about, you know, three climbers who died because X, Y, and Z, oftentimes there's a pretty glaring mistake they make or some egotistical push that they shouldn't have made. And no one who knows Chris well is concerned about that. You're not worried that Chris is going to do something stupid. So I don't have like any real fear. I just have healthy concern for him as a climber. And in terms of the mission and the project, you know, no, I don't. There's no place for fear in trying to create great art. There's no place for fear in trying to make a difference in the world. There's no place for fear if you're trying to create a new way to bring awareness and motivate people to care about blood brothers and sisters around the world. Like, there's just no room for it. So I have no fear, and I like to think of myself as something of a bulldozer when it comes to just plowing through problems as they come up. So we'll hit speed bumps with this project and this mission. Chris and I are already talking about beyond this movie, what we want to do for the developing world. There's some big ideas on the table, and we're just going to keep going no matter what.
So my last question is... Drumroll, please.
Oh my goodness, very suspenseful.
You and the Believe team, did you have a chance to do anything touristy in Nepal, or was it all business?
So I have a theory, and this is on the heels of, you know, when we go, we've been traveling around the U.S. a lot the last like 4 years, and we've made it a point when we go places to try to engage a little bit wherever we are. You know, if we're in Texas for an event, let's get some barbecue. You know, when we go to Cleveland, let's hit the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, when we're in Rhode Island, yeah, Rich Pizzillo, take me on a tour and tell me about bodies of water that I won't remember and I'll butcher the name of on the podcast.
Estuary. I mean, I'm assuming.
So you know, in Senegal, we did have a little bit of an opportunity to, we were filming everything, but we did have a little bit of an opportunity to kind of relax into the culture a little bit. And we had even more of that. The cinematographer, Josh Bragg, sound engineer, operator, Dave Beatty, and I, we were in Kathmandu for about 36 hours longer than the group that left for Everest. And during that time, we had a little B-roll to capture, but otherwise, you know, a few of us got tattoos. We went, picked up some souvenirs. We went back to the monkey temple, which we had gone to, but we were just filming. So we just went there to like take it in.
You bought your wedding band.
I bought my wedding band to get married to you with next month. And I think it's important if we're going to continue, and we are. We have, you know, we do a lot of work with the World Federation now too. And this year we're going to be going to a number of countries. I can say, I think Indonesia we're going to in June to do some filming with the Indonesian Hemophilia Society and learn a bit about their diagnosing practices, because they have some apparently pretty impressive practices for diagnosing new patients. And we have a bunch of those trips lined up between now and World Congress 2018. We're creating a bunch of videos around the world with the World Federation. I think it's important that we get to know the culture of the places that we're in. If we are saying that we are capturing the culture and the people and the lifestyle and just trying to understand hemophilia in these places, we can't understand hemophilia in these places if we don't understand these places and their culture and what makes them tick. So I think downtime is important, and you know, we can't prioritize it in the scheduling. We got to prioritize the people we're there to meet and the places we got to go to, but it influences the way you think and feel and write and edit. And I don't view it as like luxurious. I view it as enriching. And I'm extraordinarily lucky to work with people who share that mindset and that respect. You know, that's one thing we didn't, you know, get a chance to talk about, but just real quick, like the Believe guys that I was on this trip with, Rob Bradford, David Beatty, and Joshua Sterling Bragg, talk about a dream team of people to work with in exceptional circumstances. Like, these guys are amazing. And Chris even said it to me in the dinner the final night. He's like, I knew you guys a little bit, like how great everyone was, but I'm just so thankful. Like, I didn't hear one moment of anyone complaining about anything. There's no judgment. Everyone's just like open and engaging and saying yes to things. And it's like
curious.
Yeah, that's who we are. And like, that's why we want to do this kind of work. There's a lot of ways to make a buck with a camera. None of them are easy, but there's a lot of ways to do it. There's a reason that we like doing this kind of stuff. It's because we care and we want to know more. And we want to help bring that knowledge to other people through content. So we did have some downtime and it was enriching. And I think the product that we're going to create from all this is going to benefit from that.
Well, thank you, and I hope you found this interview valuable.
I did.
Both the audience and you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for doing it. It's nice to talk about it, and again, like, it's just a cool thing. Like, I hope Chris keeps saying this. You know, he had a bunch of people in the Nepal Hemophilia Society sign this Save One Life flag that he wants to bring to the summit, so that when he's up there at the highest point in the world, he can open up this flag, and he'll have all the people from Nepal there with him, you know, and that means a lot to him. I also want the community here to feel a part of this process. And so does he. He's posting pictures like every day and stories every day. So thank you for asking the questions and giving me a chance to let more people know about what we're doing, because it's significant. And I should say too, on bombardierblood.com, there is also a link to donate to the Nepal Hemophilia Society through Save One Life. Save One Life has set up a little campaign in conjunction with this. Again, the average monthly salary there is like $130 a month. So, you know, $5 goes a really long way in Nepal. So if you're interested in this, if you want to be a part of this, if something about this is speaking to you, please go to bombardierblood.com and click the link on the landing page to donate through Save One Life.
And I'd like to thank you and Chris for allowing us to attempt the summit with you.
You're welcome. Okay, now moving into our segment from the World Federation of Hemophilia's Treatment for All series that profiled the state of hemophilia care in Senegal. Let me give you a little background on what this project was about and what it is you are about to hear. So in 2015, my company, Believe Limited, accompanied a delegation from the World Federation of Hemophilia's humanitarian aid program to film what became a 10-part documentary web series on hemophilia care in the developing world and how the humanitarian aid program is working with NMOs, national member organizations around the globe, to improve care and create a pipeline of predictable, sustainable product and care for the patients in these areas. The humanitarian aid program recently expanded tremendously, and so this video series was trying to promote how that expansion was enabling them to do even more work. You can watch the videos from that series at treatmentforall.org, But just a couple weeks ago, I reached out to the folks over at World to tell them that we were creating this episode and that Believe Limited would love, it's their content, but that we would love to be able to use it so that we could share with you, the podcast audience, sound bites, interviews, and moments from that trip to Senegal where we had Senegalese community members, other African community members, from Europe. I think we had some from parts of Southeast Asia. It was a rather large delegation and many people from the World Federation. Asad Hafar, the director of the humanitarian aid program, Elaine Vey, the president of the World Federation of Hemophilia, and many other board members and people of interest to that organization. So just a great opportunity to capture moments with so many people who are instrumental in improving care in the developing world. So I reached out and asked the World Federation if we could use that content to create the segment that you're about to hear, and they very graciously said yes. So thank you to the WFH for allowing us to do that for this special World Hemophilia Day episode. And again, after you listen, if you like what you heard and you're curious to see some of the stunning images from the trip to Senegal and hear more from the people that you will hear from in just a moment, visit treatmentforall.org. You can watch all 10 parts of that series, and you can also read more about what the World Federation of Hemophilia's humanitarian aid program is doing to serve the 75% of our community around the globe that does not have access to predictable, sustainable care. So with that, I will leave you to enjoy what we're calling Voices from Senegal. Enjoy.
I could say that we have about 65 countries who are, we consider them developing countries, that we work with them for our humanitarian aid program, that we donate to them factor concentrate or clotting factor concentrate to use for their patients, particularly those who have no access to treatment products.
The humanitarian aid program of WFH was initiated in 1996, and between 1996 and 2015, we were able to send roughly 270 million of IUs to countries and to people in need all over the world.
The vision of the WFS is to have treatment for all. And treatment for all means accurate diagnosis for every person with bleeding disorders, sufficient treatment for everybody who has hemophilia, and at the same time extend this for other bleeding disorder. This is our vision.
The problem of hemophilia in Africa is a great problem. We have many undiagnosed patients, and when the patients are diagnosed, they have no access to treatment.
At this period in 1968, there is no knowledge about factor concentrates. They have no information about the technique of rice. They have no information about the danger of aspirin.
I've always said the humanitarian aid for me in my country is the difference between life and death. In 2004, I went online and searched Hemophilia Foundations, and I saw 67 organizations. I went back home and I wrote my story and sent it to all 67.
And 67 all around the world?
All around the world. And 3 days after, I got an email from Asad saying, your son's story has been flying from every corner of the world. Send me your phone number so that I can call you. And he called and asked, explained my situation. I got the first donation of treatment products from the WFH July 12, 2004. Today we have 218 identified persons with hemophilia. When I started, there was no patient support group. There was nobody for you to talk to. Today families have a network of someone you can call who can share your experience. When I started, we didn't have physiotherapists who knew anything about hemophilia. Diagnosis was zero. We were paying as much as $300 to $400 to get diagnosed. Today, because of the work we are doing together with the WFH, diagnosis is free. When I started, healthcare providers were like skeptical that hemophilia was not a black man's disease. Today we are beginning to make them believe that it's a black man's disease and has been living with us. Most developing countries share the same thing I experienced in my country. From sub-Saharan Africa to Southeast Asia, we have developing countries who are in the same range. If the World Federation's data says just 25% of persons with hemophilia receive adequate care, 75 receive low or no care at all. And that's where my country falls.
I wanted to be a priest, and the reason why I wanted to be a priest was because I wanted to give back to society. And when I failed to do that, and I completed my medical training, I noted that there was one area of patient, you know, group of patients that had been left out. If you are diagnosed with hemophilia, it was as good as being sentenced to death. The problem actually was not the disease, right. It was more of management and availability of resources. That was what was creating the difference. So in my setup, hemophilia was death. In other setups, you know, it was just a challenge. Treatment for hemophilia, for example, is very expensive. In my setup, for you to get medication for 3 days, you would sell land, you know? So I don't know for how many pieces of land you would have to sell to treat yourself. It's almost impossible. It's as good as being told, sorry, we don't need you.
One of the biggest challenges we face is the inadequacy of enough treatment products. There are times that we run out of products, and it's not because the WFA does not want to give, but it's because that is all they have. And there could be life-threatening bleeds that will come at that point in time.
Whatever we were getting actually was amounting to a 0.006 units per capita. Now, that simply means it was so little.
Insufficient.
But as little as it was still able to sustain lives. When I came back after my training, one of the first people I met was Dr. Assad. He was able to guide me on the things that he felt we needed to do. And frankly speaking, we've had a lot of achievements. One as a country, and possibly secondly, also, you know, our relationship with WFH. Because initially, I'll tell you that drugs were coming in so erratically. There was nothing that was predictable. You had clinicians coming for training, but then after the training, people are just left hopeless. You don't know what to do with a patient. But then for the last 1 year or so, we've had some very structured plans, one for our country and for patients, and basically even for the region, because we are now doing much more than just supporting our country.
Have you had moments where you've wanted to throw your hands in the air? Or?
So many times. I've had sleepless nights. I've been called at 2 a.m. of a child who fell at 10 o'clock and 10 p.m. and the mother called me at 2 a.m. There was nothing I could do. By 6 a.m. when I would call back to ask what I could do, the boy was dead. And that breaks my heart.
1 in 1,000 people around the world live with a bleeding disorder. The majority have no access to treatment.
Half the people with hemophilia in the developing world have died by the time they're 10. That's a staggering statistic, considering that the lifespan of those of us with hemophilia in the developed world is close to normal.
I have a son. I actually have two sons with hemophilia, but I came to know the WFH after my first son was born, and there was no treatment in my country. And in his first 8 years of life, he actually had 7 blood transfusions, which were the only way of keeping him alive. He had his first transfusion as a 15-day-old child. That's after bleeding for 5 days after circumcision. He's had episodes of bleeding that has ranged from that 5 days to as much as 21 days. I got to a point in my son's life, I held a son I carried in my womb for 9 months and prayed for my son to die, because there was no treatment. Presently, I have a 9-year-old girl who is our only female hemophilia with 7%. She's been in hospital for 9 weeks. She has a pseudocyst. Doctors can't go in to operate because we don't have enough products to do that. She's not been able to go to school since 2012. She already has a flexed knee. She has a pseudocyst in her ankle. And for the patients that you are serving, it's like you are disappointing them. You have given them a hope that the organization is there to help them whenever they need. Right. And they come in at this time and you tell them you can't help. It's like a disappointment. That is one of the greatest challenges we face now.
The support of World Federation Hemophilia is essential for access to treatment with humanitarian aid, because we need to have some products to treat emergencies, to treat some cases on surgery, and to avoid high mortality rate of hemophilia in their younger age.
Without those products, I don't think we will have a future for our generation. So the product, the humanitarian aid program, has always been the only source of us getting treatment products. And so it's the difference between life and death.
My life has changed. I'm more quiet. Yeah. And I know I have treatment when I want. I can work, I can do my job without thinking, hey, maybe tomorrow I will not be able to write because I will have some injury in my elbow.
You will see the difference because the patients over 20, all of them, unfortunately, they have problems in their joints and they have disability in their joints. While the difference with Bashir and Bakari, they were treated well at the beginning, so situation will get better. So with the help of the health professionals here in this center, because they are the most important people here, because they are the people who are really the soldat in Kunu doing this. With the WFH, with our corporate partners, we can help so we don't see patients disabled in the future. So we hope that every patient under 5, under 6, under 7, like Bashir and like Bakari, are going to grow normal and they don't have disability.
The World Federation of Hemophilia Expanded Humanitarian Aid Program is an excellent start to getting much more substantial amounts of product into the developing world, but it can't be done and it can't be sustained without the governments of these countries.
Without the government involvement, it's pure donation. We need an involvement of the government to start buying and start buying product, to understand that with buying products, they can treat patients, and having patients being treated when they are young. They go to school. Going to school, they learn a job. If they learn a job, then it'd be beneficial to the social life of the country. So it's essential that the government is involved in that and understand that with clotting factors, people can live a normal life.
The expanded humanitarian aid program from the WFH will never be able to satisfy the total requirements for clotting factor within each country. That's the responsibility of the government of those countries. Many of these governments need to step up and provide some measure of clotting factor to their population in addition to the humanitarian aid program from the WFH.
With the current donation that we're anticipating, take it from me, it has given life to everybody, even including myself as a clinician. It has given me life, it has given the patients life, it has given our government life, because now everyone is talking about the hemophilia program.
As patients, we can advocate to the manufacturers that we want to see substantial donation programs for the benefit of the developing world. And then as individuals, we can contribute funding to provide for additional workshops and training sessions for the management of hemophilia.
Hemophilia is the same thing across the globe, but the disparity in treatment is wide. We are all blood brothers. We need their support. We need to change the face of our children being on crutches by the age of 15, having disabled ankles or knees or elbows by the age of 12. And we can't do it alone. We need their support. We need them to move us away from the days of pain, disability, and death to the days of hope, good life, and a future.
Here in Senegal, the Senegalese government has decided to include clotting factors into their essential emergency list of medicine, which makes the importation of clotting factors easier and faster. It's fantastic when we see a government doing that. There are so many other governments which we have to pursue, to persuade, and it's very difficult because obviously they have other tasks to perform. But here in Senegal, they seem to have understood. And I wish that in the other countries of the sub-region here in Africa, other governments will understand the same and will follow suit.
I don't know whether it will be too much to ask if we can possibly be planning ahead so that as we keep increasing the number of patients into our flock, we also increase the amount of donation so that then we don't flop backwards.
Right.
So really mine is to thank the donors, but at the same time just let them know that we are dealing with a relatively small population. And if all goes well, we are likely to add more, and that potentially means, possibly either adding the donation or supporting WFH to continue supporting other programs.
I live with severe hemophilia. When I was born, treatment did not exist. I know what it's like to go from a future of uncertainty, living with the prospect of early death or growing up severely disabled, to one of certainty, where I have the opportunity for a full and rich life. The need has never been greater, and the opportunity for us to have a global impact has never been greater.
Before Natalie and I dole out our parting shots and wrap up this episode, I want to one more time give a big thank you to Shire for supporting the Bloodstream podcast. As you'll hear in the credits coming up in just a moment, it takes a small army to make this podcast happen, and we simply could not do it without the generous support from Shire. So we want to thank them for enabling us to produce this modern, digital, community-focused resource for the bleeding disorders community. Thanks, Shire. I'd like to thank the WFH for allowing us to edit that material together and present it to you here on the Bloodstream podcast. And again, if you'd like to take a look at that entire 10-part web series, or if you'd like to learn more about the humanitarian aid program from the World Federation of Hemophilia, visit treatmentforall.org, where you will find the opportunity to learn more about both the series and the program. And with that, Natalie, we are coming up on the end of our episode here, which, as you just said earlier before we started, this is the last time you'll be telling people that your name's Natalie DeLillo, because...
because next month I will be a married woman.
You will. So Natalie and I are getting married next month.
And I'm changing my last name.
She is. She's giving up DeLillo for Lynch. I think DeLillo's a cooler last name, but, you know, we're not going to get into the whole reason behind this. That being said, this is the last time you're going to be saying that, because next month is also our 1 year as the Bloodstream podcast. And since we will be away on honeymoon and it's our 1 year anniversary as a podcast, we thought it'd be cool to do a best of episode. So next month's episode is going to be a highlight reel of the first 11 episodes of the Bloodstream podcast. I'm really excited to hear how Mr. Andrew Gall and Mr. Ryan Geelan put that together, because we've done a lot in the past year, and it'll be neat to kind of hear it all again, and not hear it all again, but hear the highlights.
No one's tuning in.
10-hour episode. It's just one after the next. There'll be one super fan who listens to it as they sleep.
Or maybe listen to it to put them to sleep.
Well, I mean, it would do it.
There are podcasts for that, actually. Like, if you have insomnia, podcasts where they tell you Icelandic bedtime stories very slow.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And it just puts you to sleep.
Yeah.
So
I use podcasts.
I don't remember what it's called, but please don't use Bloodstream as a put you to bed. That would make me
sad.
I'm
sure some people do.
I'm sure too.
If you use Bloodstream to put you to bed, let us know. You can email us at Bloodstream. all right, let's do parting shots and wrap this up. So parting shots, just one top of mind, bleeding disorders or otherwise consideration, something you're thinking of that you want to share just before we sign off here. So Natalie, go ahead, kick us off with your parting shot for the month of April.
My parting shot for April is when you were in Nepal, a couple weeks ago, and I was in LA. My friend Katie came out to visit, and we decided to be LA tourists. And we went to The Price is Right, and it was one of the most fun experiences of my life.
Why is that?
The production's just as you would imagine it to be, the lights and the set, and you know, I feel like it's such a multi-generational show. Like, your grandmother watched The Price is Right. You know, your mother
watched it with her a lot.
Yeah, it's something that you say that, and someone knows someone in their family who watches that all the time and has seen it through all the hosts. And so it was just kind of cool. It was just a cool experience, and it was so fun. And my friend Katie won some money.
Hey, congratulations.
But yeah, so
Katie,
it's just something fun to share. And it'll be airing June 20th. If, we got the worst seats in the house, so I don't know how much we're going to be panned to as audience members. But, tune in. It's the summer beach party episode, so on the solstice, and it'll get you excited for summer.
Cool. All right. Fair enough. June 20th. The Price is Right. We just plugged The Price is Right.
On the Bloodstream.
On the Bloodstream podcast. Things I never thought I'd do for 500, Bob.
Wrong game show.
Yeah.
And what's your parting shot, Patrick?
Next week's episode. My parting shot is that, you know, one of the cool parts about international travel, and it takes a long time to get to places like Kathmandu, Nepal. But I watched a bunch of movies, and you know, you don't have internet on these planes, and I just took the advantage of the opportunity with between downloadable Netflix and British Airways in-flight entertainment. I got to catch up on a bunch of movies that I haven't seen that I wanted to see, and it was really inspiring to see movies like Beasts of No Nation, Manchester by the Sea. Arrival was surprisingly emotionally interesting to me. So it was just a nice reminder of entertainment. And, you know, you've heard me talk about this, Natalie, and some people around us. But, you know, my background is as an actor, and it's something that has gotten kind of shoved to the background for the last few years. You know, I do Stop the Bleeding, obviously, and I'm hosting this. I host Powering Through. I host the Impact Awards. I give speeches. But it's not acting. Other than Stop the Bleeding, which is just that one thing, it's not acting. And I got to act in Elsewhere, and that was fun, a movie I directed that is coming out this year. And I won an award for that, which felt like, oh, nice, that's cool, like, people like me acting. And I don't know, watching these movies and just thinking about the arts and thinking about the documentary with Chris, I'm just excited to be an artist right now. And it's nice to find that. To kind of like reignite that passion a little bit, and not let the advocacy interest and the business interest, and, you know, my personal life has obviously changed a lot in the last few years. We're getting married, but to amidst all that, still feel like, oh yeah, not only is that thing in me, but it actually wants to kind of be brought up to the front more now. It's good. It's exciting, and I'm interested in seeing how exactly I can make that a more prominent part of my output. Haven't quite figured that part out yet, but I think I have some ideas. It's getting close. What are you whispering over there?
Oh, I was just gonna say, stay tuned.
Oh, stay tuned. I'm sorry. That she's trying to tell me, hey, can you wrap it up, long-winded Miggy? All right, so stay tuned, and you'll find out some more stuff. But anyway, that's my parting shot. So watch The Price is Right on June 20th, and stay tuned for more information about Patrick as an actor. And with that is all for this episode of Bloodstream. Don't forget to check out the BloodstreamMedia.com website, BloodstreamMedia.com, and subscribe to the Ask the Expert in Powering Through podcast series, as well as our brand new Bloodline series, kicking off with our VWD deep dive. You'll hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community at BloodstreamMedia.com. And if you have a question for Ask the Expert or an idea for a future episode, please email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on Facebook, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. This episode of Bloodstream was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie DeLillo, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Ava Friedman, and Colby Crow, and the Bloodstream podcast is edited by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everybody at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, and Shire, our supporter, through an unrestricted educational grant. And special thanks as well to everyone who has helped make these first 11 episodes as strong and fantastic as they are. And I hope you enjoy the mashup celebratory one-year anniversary episode next month for the month of May. A reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories and topics featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And for the last time, I'm Natalie DeLillo.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.